This episode of Section D with Hugo MacDonald was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 5th of March on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up on today's show, we hear how Canadian author Douglas Copeland turned his hand from books to furniture design.
The pieces in the collection are made here in British Columbia, up the coast. Smart, intelligent, non-toxic, really gorgeously made stuff, and I'm very, very proud of it that way.
We attend the ribbon cutting of Spanish oil giant Repsol's sparkling new headquarters in Madrid.
It's a building around a Spanish patio, and all the life is in this patio. This is the main aim of this architecture, a living space.
And we'll be finding out how the ancient building technique of earth architecture is having a revival in Jordan.
It's interesting because a lot of people ask us, is this durable kind of architecture? And we're like, well, this is 10,000 years old and it's still there.
Plus, we'll head to Vienna to hear how young architects there are being given a helping hand. We'll find out why one couple in New Jersey are keen to move their Frank Lloyd Wright house brick by brick across the Atlantic. And we'll have a snoop around the studio of Zurich architect Diego Zanghi too. That's all to come over the next hour here on Section D. We begin this week with a little history lesson in the Middle East. Earth architecture, the mysterious art of creating buildings out of compressed mud in a sustainable fashion, is making a surprise comeback in one of the places of its origin. In the Jordan Valley, near the ancient city of Jericho, where 10,000-year-old structures built only out of earth still stand, a group of Palestinian architects from Ramallah are busy building new homes, using mud brick and other compressed earth materials. For the architects, their obsession with sustainable materials is as much political as it is ecological, and they're beginning to turn some heads, as Monocle's Joseph Dana found out in the West Bank.
Under a beating winter sun, just past the entrance of one of the world's oldest cities, Palestinian construction workers place large bags of compressed earth on top of one another in a timelessly Middle Eastern pattern of domes and arches. The simple bags of earth are connected internally by barbed wire and held up by wooden scaffolding. In little less than 1 month, the scaffolding will be removed and a house created entirely with raw earth materials will emerge.
It's a small kitchen. There's a little breakfast area right here. And then this is the main room. This is the living room, and that's a fireplace and a wind chimney. So it works both ways. In the winter, it heats the home, and in the summer, it cools it.
That's Dana Massad, a Palestinian architect with the Shams Art Design Studio in Ramallah, showing me around their latest earth architecture project in the ancient city of Jericho. Shams Ard, which translates to earth and sun, has been busy bringing fresh ideas for sustainable design and architecture to Palestine. Currently, the studio is working on 6 earth architecture projects in the Jordan Valley, including 5 women's centers, which are partially funded by UNESCO. But can buildings made out of dirt withstand the harsh elements of the Jordan Valley, one of the lowest points on earth? Massad is quick to dispel the naysayers.
Traditionally, the type of architecture in the Jordan Valley is earth architecture, adobe specifically, adobe bricks. So you'll find one of the oldest human settlements in the world in Jericho, Tal Sultan. If you go there, you'll actually find ruins that are still exist from adobe bricks, like parts of houses and fences and that kind of stuff. So it's interesting because a lot of people ask us, is this durable kind of architecture? And we're like, well, this is 10,000 years old and it's still there.
Earth architecture in Palestine has been inspired almost completely by the work of 2 Middle Eastern architects, Iranian-born Nader Khalili and the Egyptian architect Hassan Fatah. Halili founded the California Institute for Earth Art and Architecture in 1986 and arrived at the idea of earth architecture through an unlikely process. Massad explained exactly how Halili came up with the idea.
He first developed this technique during a contest for NASA for building something on the moon, for building a house on the moon. And his suggestion was just if you take a roll of bags and barbed wire, you can build a house on the moon by filling it with whatever soil is there and then tamping it in. And later on, he developed it so that it's for an emergency shelter. And people just took it on because it's a cheaper way to build with earth and you don't need anything but, you know, materials that you already have, like these bags.
Underlying the work of Massad and her fellow architects is the simple desire to highlight how sustainable design can be used by Palestinians living in the West Bank, which has been under Israeli occupation since 1967. Instead of telling Palestinians that alternatives to unsustainable concrete architecture exist, this new generation of designers, with Massad at the helm, are creating quiet masterpieces of earth architecture.
We're just not we don't think the way that we're going about construction is a very sustainable way to go about it. Because we're not using materials that are local, we're destroying the environment by doing it. We're literally wiping out a lot of hills through quarries. The construction waste is all over the areas around towns. And so it's just, you can see the consequences of the way we're doing things, and it's not pretty. And so we're trying to say that there is an alternative, or we're trying to figure out if there is an alternative, actually, and also that we could do it locally and using our own materials without destroying the environment, without destroying our own resources.
More projects are on the horizon for Shams Art, including a restaurant in Jericho and another private home. The sustainable earth architecture design of their projects places them in the ranks of other design studios using this ancient but increasingly visible building method. Yet, Shams Art is different. At every turn of the process of creating new houses and buildings out of earth, Palestinian history remains as important as the very earth itself.
Look, our ancestors have figured out how to live with nature, and this is true everywhere in the world. And they've come to a certain amount of knowledge that we kind of let go of when we adopted all these, I want to say, Western way of life. A commercialized way of life, and for Palestinians, it's really, really important to reconnect with our own identity and our history, and because there's so much effort to erase that, that this we find crucial for us as architects to know our history and what thousands of years of experience in building has produced.
Earth architecture projects are popping up from Chile to Brazil to South Africa, but in the sun-drenched Jordan Valley, where some of the world's oldest earth buildings still stand, the architectural style takes on a special meaning. Some Palestinians are finding that this ancient form of creation just happens to be one which nourishes them with a sense of sustainability and independence. For Monocle, in Jericho, I'm Joseph Dana.
Thank you for that, Joseph. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Lots more coming up, including a tour of Repsol's new Madrid headquarters, in the presence of royalty, no less. But next up, we'll be visiting author Douglas Copeland's home in Vancouver.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture, and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favorite programs using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald, here on Monocle 24. From Generation X and Girlfriend in a Coma to J-Pod and Old Families Are Psychotic, Douglas Copeland is mostly fated for writing an arsenal of books. But his creative output has always involved designing furniture, including early days crafting cots for a firm near his home city of Vancouver and making so-called target tables with concentric circles in bold colours. Today he's designed a new collection featuring an escritoire, a writer's seat, floor lamps and bookcases, all inspired by Copeland's own writer's nook. Popping into that inner sanctum, reporter Lucy Hislop discovers the importance of Asia on Copeland's work and why he feels he's never really left art.
Wanted to have a song to go with the escritoire experience, and probably the theme song from Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence by Ryuichi Sakamoto would probably be the perfect tune. I mean, yes, here I am. It's Vancouver, Canada. And I think 53% of people speak Cantonese or Mandarin at home. And it's a very Asian influence. I went to art school in Japan after I went to art school here in Vancouver. I went to the Hokkaido College of Art and Design in Sapporo, Japan, and the European Design Institute in Milan, Italy. I mean, my big goal was always to work in Japan within the real Japanese economy, not just as a, you know, professional gaijin or a Tokyo Journal or just. And so a lot of what looks like random education in my past is actually what I was doing, gearing towards working in Japan. I actually have a business degree in Japanese business science, of all things, from a school in Honolulu and Sophia University in Tokyo. You know, I mean, writing was the accident in my life. It started by accident in 87. So I don't know, I mean, words and images, I don't even know if my brain separates the two. I think, so like so many things in life, it's just regulated by whatever you were born with.
Douglas Copeland is chatting as we tour his Post and Beam home in West Vancouver. There's a veritable embarrassment of colour, wood and multi-stacked pieces of art in every room before we enter his den where, taking central stage, is the bright lacquered writing desk that sparked the synapses to design his latest furniture collection.
About 3 years ago, I broke my leg and at the same time got really smoking hot Wi-Fi here in the house. And the moment you get Wi-Fi, every room in your house becomes a new room. The library became the TV room. The dining room became the work area. Things got scrambled. And then, of course, I couldn't go from A to B. And I ended up working inside the house rather than in an outbuilding where I'd been working before. And I needed something very concentrated that I could also just close up and be mine. I mean, it's a really archaic furniture category, the escritoire, the secretary. I mean, your mind goes right back to like Josephine and Napoleon. So I found an old beater on Craigslist, got it home, redid all the hardware and had it lacquered in a sort of really Japanese bento box lacquer color. And I just found it was a really wonderful, concentrated way of focusing on writing. Because the thing about writing long-form fiction, novels or what have you, is that you have to do it every day and you have to be at a certain spot every day and you have to have your ritual. And if you don't have that, you're basically a fraud. And so I had to create a place where I didn't mind being every single day and almost like an altar of sorts. So that's how I ended up bonding with the escritoire. And then I'm in Vancouver and there's a company here, William Switzer Furniture, and William's son Alan has his own company. Switzer Cult Creative, and we've known each other forever. We had a dealer at one point. It's Vancouver, it's not that big a town. He wanted to do something sort of small and, you know, like not a huge furniture line, so we will ask, why not do this, Alan? It seemed like a very natural fit.
As he puts the escritoire into action, he explains there was a significant nod to his childhood for this personal piece.
You're looking at the inside of my desk / my brain, like chaos and disorder, but I closed the door in. Ta-da! All you see is a tasteful exterior, none of the mess inside. Voila! I grew up with three brothers and no privacy at all. And so everything I owned would get trashed or destroyed or mangled or desecrated or whatever. And now that I'm an adult, part of the pleasure of being an adult is not having my brothers around and not having my stuff get wrecked. And the thing about an escritoire with a lid is that you simply close it. You know, the pig pen inside, which is a direct metaphor for my brain, is sealed off. It's safe. It's not vulnerable. I like that very much. Wanted to design a piece that has, let's say any piece of furniture, a presence, sort of a mood about it, so that when you see it, it puts your head in a certain mode. I mean, the difference between 1813 and 2013 is that we have holes in the back of escritoires now for cords to go through, but that's about it. I mean, it's not a piece of furniture that's for everyone. It's not even elitist. It's just borderline silly, really, to have something like this. But if you're into it, you're into it.
A committed two-fingered typist, Copeland designed the pieces using one of his favorite programs, Photoshop. Choosing color was a doddle for him. From the bento box red of the desk and the special edition paint box version with multicolored storage boxes to the maple and purple of the lamps inspired by the Roanji temple in Kyoto.
Everyone's visual to some level. Everyone's into color at some level. I think in my case, it's almost like a medical pathology that unless I'm actually looking at about five different colors at once or having them on my retina, I go into a sort of decline.
As lovely as the nook is, it's when we head into his garden that another major driver for this collection seems obvious. He's showing me his cedar trees and the thick shrubbery that shields his home, while down the slope there's a perfect frame of the expansive Stanley Park and the shimmering skyline of Vancouver, otherwise known as his City of Glass.
Well, the pieces in the collection are made here in British Columbia, up the coast. Smart, intelligent, non-toxic, really gorgeously made stuff, and I'm very, very proud of it that way. Again, we're in British Columbia. Down the hill from where we are now, three times a day, there's a freight train with 120 cars, each loaded up with plywood coming from the north. And all that stuff's leaving British Columbia. We don't do anything with this stuff, and it's kind of spooky and weird and creepy. And, you know, it's nice just to make something really good that is from here and of here. I think that's probably what the future is more about, is things that are from where you are.
And when it comes to Copeland recreating his very own writing space in this collection, it's most definitely from where he is. For Monocle, in Vancouver, I'm Lucy Hislop.
How utterly charming. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald. If you're lucky enough to own a house by legendary American architect Frank Lloyd Wright, it's not something you'd happily give up. But one couple, the owners of the Backman Wilson House, built by Lloyd Wright in the 1950s in New Jersey, are going further than most to hold on to their prized home. Due to repeated flooding and the ensuing damage, the owners, Mr. and Mrs. Tarantino, are looking to move the house, brick by brick, to either upstate New York or possibly as far as Italy. To discuss if this is even possible and what the consequences might be for the stunning Lloyd Wright House, I was joined on the line by Janet Hulsted, Executive Director of the Frank Lloyd Wright Building Conservancy.
Well, it's a very lovely Frank Lloyd Wright house, and at the Frank Lloyd Wright Building Conservancy, we work with all the owners of Frank Lloyd Wright buildings, and we support all appropriate efforts to preserve the built work of Frank Lloyd Wright. In this particular case, this house has experienced extensive and repeated flooding, so much so that it is beginning to damage the structure itself. And so, although our position has always been that Wright buildings should remain on their original site, occasionally we've made exceptions on that, and we feel that these owners have currently taken all the measures they possibly could to find an alternative solution, but there are none. And so moving the house is a solution of last resort, which in this particular case we support.
And just to be clear, is it flooding through bad weather, or is it the site that it's built on that means that it is going to be repeatedly flooded, and really there's nothing that can be done to shore that up and sort of try and keep the foundations where they are?
Well, it is suffering more and more from increased flooding from hurricanes and bad storms, but this was exacerbated also by not just a natural occurrence, but by some construction of some things that were supposed to help water management in the area, but unfortunately did not help this particular house and others in their surrounding neighborhood, and in fact made the flooding situation worse. And although they've tried to work out solutions with the local authorities, there doesn't seem to be anything that can be done at this point except to move the house in order to save it.
And there's been sort of reports that the house might be moved to upstate New York, but also maybe to Italy. What is the determining factor in this?
Well, I think at this point, since the decision has been made by the owners with the support of the Conservancy to try and move it in order to save it, it would be ideal to move it to something closer by in the region, because that's more true to the original site where the building was located, if they can find the same kind of topography and vegetation and solar orientation. But if that's not, if they can't find an owner who's willing to take on this house, a new owner, because actually they're offering it for sale to a new owner who would move it. And these owners, the current owners, are architects, and they understand what's involved with dismantling and reconstructing a house and are willing to help in that reconstruction. So if a new owner could be found in a closer kind of environment, that would be ideal. Mm-hmm. But if not, perhaps it would have to move much farther afield, and at least there is a historical connection to the area that they're looking at in Fiesole in Italy, because Wright spent some time there.
Yes, I gather. So would they ideally sell it before moving it, or are they so desperate to sell it that they would sell it and then move it afterwards?
Yes, that would be part of the sale, would be the understanding that it would be moved.
And you mentioned a little bit earlier that similar incidents have happened before where the building's been deconstructed and relocated. How difficult is it actually to take a Frank Lloyd Wright building apart and then rebuild it sort of brick by brick?
Well, the more modern structures, it is possible, although, again, as I said, you know, should only be done as a last resort in order to save it. We were involved with another Wright house. This was in Oregon. That was under an immediate threat of demolition. So again, this was only a solution of the last resort after some intensive negotiations. The Frank Lloyd Wright Building Conservancy was able to convince the owner to donate that building to us and also receive some tax considerations for that, because we're a charitable organization. And then the Conservancy negotiated with others to move it to a site that was about 25 miles away where it could be reconstructed. So it is now an open functioning house museum in Oregon at the Oregon Garden Foundation under their auspices, and is protected from further threats of demolition by a preservation easement. So it is doable. And in this case, I think because the owners who are selling the home are architects, they have a very good understanding of how this can be done. So basically, they would take the house off of its concrete slab and number the pieces and reconstruct it in a new location.
That was Janet Halstead, Executive Director of the Frank Lloyd Wright Building Conservancy. Time now for a song, and one of my favourite songs actually name-checks Frank Lloyd Wright. How fitting. Here's Sufjan Stevens with Come On, Feel the Illinois.
Oh God of progress, have you degraded or forgot us? Where have your love? about it now.
That was Sufjan Stevens with Come On Feel the Illinois. You're listening to Section D. Still to come in part two, we'll be dropping in on a brilliant Viennese firm that helps give a leg up to young Austrian architects. And we'll have a tour of architect Diego Zangi's Zurich studio too. But before that, we're off to Spain. Spanish resource giant Repsol recently inaugurated its new corporate headquarters in Madrid. It was a royal affair, with the Spanish crown prince in attendance to cut the ribbon, and all the requisite pomp and ceremony that a grand project such as this entails. While the Spanish media were busy swamping the royal guest, our Madrid correspondent tracked down the real star of the show, the building's architect, Rafael de la Hoz. He's being commended for designing a new benchmark for corporate offices, a bold departure from the standard soaring skyscraper. La Hoz has brought the immense structure down to earth, uniting four buildings which form the shape of a square, creating a vast, light-filled outdoor space in the middle for the HQ's 4,000 workers to enjoy. With the winter sun shining bright, Liam joined Rafael to discuss the project.
Repsol's first idea was to design and erect a tower 300 meter high. And they commissioned Norman Foster for the tower. And they erected. But when they was going to move from the old buildings to the new tower, they reconsidered all the process. Really unbelievable. And they thought, well, that the tower is not the shape for us, because we are an industrial company and more horizontal staff structure. So they got this piece of land in the center of Madrid, and they asked me if it could be possible to create a more horizontal building, splitting four buildings, because the company works like most of the petrol company, like a part of the company extract the petrol, and the other half of the company sell the petrol. No?
So it's really reflecting equality in the architecture.
Yes, I think so. Because the big difference between the tower and this building is that this building is not a campus. They call it a campus, but it's not a campus. It's not in the campus, it's in the city. And this is a cluster. It's a building or an architecture around an empty space, around a Spanish patio. And all the life is in this patio. In English, there are a word in English for patios as courtyard. But when a British or English courtyard is a living space, the word they use is patio, the Spanish word. That's what it explains in a very, very clear way, that when you live in a courtyard, it's in a patio. This is the main aim of this architecture, a living space.
This is something that we at Monocle complain about quite a lot, is that in some buildings, particularly in London, they don't utilize the space around the buildings, and a lot of the workers have to go far away to get lunch, or the gardens aren't used for the people, they're just there to look nice. This space is designed so that people that work here can come down and have lunch and really use the space. Is that something you wanted to encourage and really emphasize?
Exactly. But life in the city has to balance between what you said is the life around, that is really important for the life of the city and the building, and life inside. And we try to balance between the incredible offer of bars and restaurants in Madrid and surrounding the building, and the offer inside the building with the cafeteria and shops, gymnasium, etc.
What about the building itself? We just look around, it's mainly glass, but it's not all glass. Did you wanted to really bring light into the building and really save on power costs? And tell me a little bit about the environmental credentials.
I'm working out of Spain, so I know what is the difference between light in other countries. Madrid, Spain, the light is not the problem here. The problem is to avoid the light. It's too much. Some many cases, no? So here the structure of the building is out of the building, in outside the skin. And that's have the advantage to get a free space inside, no columns inside the office space. And at the same time, the structure outside is shading this glass.
It's almost like a vertebrae.
Exactly, exactly, like a vertebrae. Yeah? There are a kind of this theological building, and inside this structure, the life arises. The life arises in Spain or southern countries on the shadow, under the shadow. But during a shade, it starts to rise up. Yeah? That the architect have to create shadow with the trees and the structure. In fact, the trees is a natural biological form, and the building is an artificial shape for the same purpose, to create a shadow.
What's your opinion on architecture in Spain at the moment? Are they lacking these kind of ideals? Are they still kind of steeped in old ways of thinking?
When the crisis started in Spain, around the world, especially in Spain in 2008, The Economist released a number, an issue, a monography for Spain. And The Economist said, this is the country of the success of the sport, gastronomy, and architecture. And I agree with them. They are the three flagship of the image of the Spain, of the Spain label. And architecture have an incredible prestige, the Spanish architecture, around the world. But now is the moment to work abroad, because this experience has to be used for develop different language, different countries, different culture.
Can we just talk a little bit more about the building itself? Can you explain a little bit more about the concept? When they came to you to ask you about, asked you to create a more horizontal structure, what was your initial idea? Can you explain to me a little the process?
About the process. In this area of Madrid, it's really the center. It's downtown, because the railway station of Atocha is just 400 meters from here. So we decided to respect all the regulation and zoning with all the specification about height, depth of the building, floor, etc. To respect and respect the surrounding. The second one was to make something very transparent, to integrate, because the surrounding is residential. This is not office, like a campus or those areas. So I like it very much because it was the opportunity to integrate a real city. And real cities, as you said some minutes ago, bars around the theater, the cinema, residential, and offices. And I like it much more, this kind of city, than those new cities that we are creating all together, that split the city in an area of zoning for living, zoning for enjoyment or entertainment, zoning for working. This is really, really sad. I think it's much more attractive if the city are this kind of city that everything is together and all the people are together and living or enjoying.
That was Spanish architect Rafael de la Hoz with our Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous there. You're listening to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald, on Monocle 24. After this interlude, we'll be heading to Vienna to talk bureaucratic red tape and how young architects can duck underneath it to get their work off the ground.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
It's just always going to be different, for me at least. I've never recorded an album in the same place under the same circumstances as the last record, so it's always going to be quite different.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
The main market used to be Europe, of course, United States and Japan. Now you have tens of markets, very interesting, also regions. You have, of course, Russia, then you have Kazakhstan, you have so many other. It's a completely different world.
What could be greater than an hour of The Curator? Listen to it live or download it later.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
This is Section D on Monocle 24. Welcome back. It's always a struggle for young architects to get noticed in the industry. Administrative and legal problems lie behind every corner. This is especially true of such a bureaucracy-laden country as Austria. But thankfully, there are helpers at hand. Alexei Korolyov reports on a Vienna-based group, IG Architecta, which helps young Austrian architects around some of the snags of the job.
Success in architecture often depends more on an ability to beat red tape than on talent. Nowhere in Europe is it more true than in Austria. The country's young architecture is mired in bureaucracy. But a campaigning group formed in 2001 is trying to usher in a brighter future for the profession. Matthias Finkente is a spokesman for IGE Architektur.
In the beginning, the most important problem was how there was access for the younger officers to competitions to be able to work.
That problem aside, there were also insurance matters to be settled with the Chamber of Architects, the official regulatory body for architects in Austria.
If you had become a member of the Chamber of Architects, then they had a kind of social insurance, which was not compatible with the normal social insurances.
IGE Architektur has got that out of the way too. Today, Finkente says, the group even has representation in the chamber, which was formerly dominated almost exclusively by older architects.
Since 2 years, we have also a group of people who are elected in the chamber. So we are working from outside and from inside, which is a lot of work, but we hope that it will be successful.
And there is still a lot to work on. Christian Kronaus, who currently holds the group's rotating presidency, says the interests of young architects are endangered by developers.
I think that the developers' world is very strong, increasing here in Austria, and also this connection between the political world and the developers' world is very strong, and it becomes even stronger. So the architect is kind of neglected, let's say. Yeah.
That sentiment is echoed by Martin Putschogl, an architectural writer for Austria's daily Der Standard. Putschogl says that despite IGE Architektur's efforts, it is the developers and contractors, not the architects, who have the final say in most projects.
There are often competitions where there is a winner. The office celebrates the success, and then when it comes to building the house, they have to change many things because there is the building company that says we don't want this, make another plan for this.
One instance of this is the Seestadt, a district which is being built from scratch on the outskirts of the Austrian capital of Vienna. It is a new and daring project, but many of its more innovative ideas have been rejected by the site's developers, who fear that they may scare off potential property buyers. Another problem for young Austrian architects, says writer Martin Putschogl, is that most offices are too small to do big projects.
You need big manpower for the projects, and the smaller offices, some of them only with 2, 3, 4 people, they can't do this.
And getting this manpower together is something which IGE Architektur has also been trying to do. To date, it has about 260 members.
The main thing is that you know there is somebody, there are colleagues, friends.
For Nikolaus Westhauser, head of the Stadtgut Architects, it is the spirit of camaraderie which exists between IGE Architektur members that makes it so special. Westhauser says he feels comfortable knowing that there is always somebody to fall back on.
I got a lot of friends out of IG Architecture, and to know there is somebody behind you where you can be sure they help you, they think the same, they are in the same situation.
It also feels like that for Marion Gruber, who designed IG Architecture's office. She says the group helped her make new contacts.
It helped me, I think, for networking and something like this. You get to know a lot of people here with many different knowledges.
Gruber says that the group's diverse membership, which includes journalists and politicians as well as architects, means that she can always seek advice from fellow members.
In the IG, there are a lot of experts about Vienna, city urban planning, details, whatever, so you can question your colleagues.
The group's spokesman, Matthias Finkente, says that the main form of communication between its members is a simple mailing list.
And this is the kind of special discussion forum where people ask for jobs, where people offer jobs, where people ask whether other colleagues know the name or address of a person who can help to construct a building.
Finkente says it is its emphasis on these essential needs of the architects that sets IG Architektur apart from Austria's other architectural groups.
Most of the architectural organizations are focusing on architecture. We are focusing on the architects.
But most importantly, says architect Christian Kronaus, the group's loose structure means that it affords its members incomparable freedoms.
The IG Architektur has the potential to articulate ideas, since it's not so legally strictly organized. Yeah, so it has more space and more freedom.
And with this freedom as their main weapon, the group is already making the lives of young architects in Austria a lot easier. And there is surely more to come. For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Thank you for that, Alexei. And that's all we have time for on today's episode of Section D. Next week, we'll be back with a look at how one heritage stationery brand has turned its profits around in the UK. We'll take a tour around Le Corbusier's only house in Latin America. And we'll hear how design and architecture is being used in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict too. Be sure to tune in then. Today's show was produced by Alid John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer, Alid, at awj@monocle.com if you want to feature on Section D, or maybe just bend his ear about an idea you might have had. I'm Hugo MacDonald, and before we go, it's time to head to our studio of the week. This week, we dropped into the studio of architect Diego Zangi at the border of the old town of Zurich. Zangi worked and studied in Zurich, Berlin, and then London, and opened his office in Zurich just 3 years ago with his two partners, Daniela Eberli and Daniel Vega. He began by telling us about the history of his studio.
I think this place is very special because basically we are on the border of the old town, the medieval old town in Zurich. So to one side you have, to the Neumarkt, you have the townhouse, and where we are is more, I assume it was a garden place at some point, but now it's like a workshop, and it used to be a carpenter's workshop. So the place has a very nice history. It's like a workshop where you make things, and that's what we do as well. Even if it's sometimes just drawings or model making, but it's always something, it's quite crafted, and I think that's the nice thing about the architectural business. We surround ourselves with materials. Materials is really important to us. Actually for any project, like may it be a large scale housing project to a small scale refurbishment of an old house near the lake, for example. So being surrounded by materials, touching the materials, understanding the materials, how you use them, that's an important thing. So if we go upstairs, you have the wall lined up with materials. May it be materials we collect from the site, if it's like a refurbishment of a building, or new materials you want to introduce to a new project. The there certainly is a daily routine that you have, and it's obviously we start in the morning and you go through your emails and you go through your drawings or whatever the task is at the day, in the day. But I think there is a bigger scale to routine, which is how the office works or how the three partners work together. And so with explaining like this, that it starts with, you know, a project. When you start a new project, it's all three coming together, discussing, designing, and then someone takes the lead on the project. But then on a regular routine, you come back and you discuss it, And so that's basically how you bring the project to a really precise let's call it like an amazing stage. And also it's like the routine, how we do stuff. So our office consists of an interior architect, someone who studied at DTH, is probably assumed to be more theory based. Myself, I come more from a vocational training. And I think the nice thing is that we can switch our roles. So, you know, the interior architect would do architecture as well. The one that you would assume has a theory-based education from DETH, he leads the construction side. Me, with vocational training, goes into theory because I also teach at the University of Applied Science in Lucerne. So, it is this routine that, you know, we switch our roles, and that's very important because it helps to bring the project but also the office further. The song I've chosen is by the band called Einstürzende Neubauten, and it's called, the song title is Architektur ist Geiselname, so architecture can take you hostage. It's a song that has been following me for a long, long time, and I obviously see it in a positive sense, in a positive meaning too. Architecture can take you to hostage.
Ein Senkblatt als Winkelmaß der Geschichte. Was der Sänger singt, ist, was der Sänger sieht.